WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, how about setting an alarm clock for bedtime rather than to wake up? Arianna Huffington is trying it. She'll be here with WNYC President Laura Walker and other top managers to talk about workplace experiments with helping American employees get more sleep. Also today, advocates report card, subject crime. How's Mayor de Blasio doing after 6 months in office? At public safety and respectful policing, can he accomplish both? And the new thing to own in New York? A personal drone, apparently. We will look at the pros, cons, and safety risks. But first, there is breaking news this morning from the Middle East, where Israel has accepted an Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire with Hamas. But apparently, Hamas not so much. And the fighting, as you just heard on the BBC, has resumed the bombardment of Gaza by Israel. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry a short time ago.
We're talking about lifting the siege on Gaza. That's been since 8 years. We're talking about opening the borders. We're talking about just living as any free community in the world. So it's enormous.
Sorry, that's a Palestinian spokesman who we'll get to in a minute. Here's Secretary Kerry.
I cannot condemn strongly enough the actions of Hamas in so brazenly firing rockets in multiple numbers in the face of a goodwill effort to offer a ceasefire.
Now, this non-ceasefire, at least for now, comes after more than a week of deadly bombing of missile sites in Gaza in response to Hamas rocket fire into new parts of Israel. Stephen Erlanger, New York Times London bureau chief, but long their Jerusalem bureau chief, joins us from Jerusalem with the latest and some bigger picture thoughts on this latest round of war, even as John Kerry was trying to broker a larger peace. Hello from New York, Stephen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot. Good to be there.
Has Hamas firmly rejected this Egyptian ceasefire proposal, firmly and explicitly?
They have firmly and explicitly rejected it, but at the same time, others in Hamas say that they are undergoing consultations, which will take some time. So as often is the case, you get some contradiction. I mean, the problem for Hamas is its normal political leadership is underground in Gaza. They're not picking their heads up for obvious reasons. And if there is going to be a ceasefire deal, it should probably be done with Hamas's political chief, Khaled Meshaal, who's in Qatar.
On Morning Edition, at least one Palestinian spokesman was popping his head up enough to do, I guess, a phone interview with Steve Inskeep. And Inskeep asked this deputy information minister named Ihab al-Ghussein for the Palestinian government in Gaza about conditions under which Hamas would accept a ceasefire. And here's part of his response.
We're talking about lifting the siege on Gaza. That's been since 8 years. We're talking about opening the borders. We're talking about just living as any free community in the world. So it's enormous conditions, but nobody talks to us directly to ask us about the stance of this ceasefire was declared by the Egyptians.
So he mentioned we're talking about lifting the siege. That's been 8 years. We're talking about opening the border, things that would allow people to live under normal conditions. So it sounds like, if that's an accurate representation of anything, that the Gazans want some bigger structural changes, not just quiet for quiet in a ceasefire.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the whole point of the Egyptian proposal was that the ceasefire should go into effect at 9 in the morning. And then during this period would be talks between Israel and Hamas brokered by Egypt about the nature of the ceasefire and understandings. So all that you know, can be seen as negotiating points. What actually happened today is that Israel agreed in a contentious cabinet meeting to accept the ceasefire and stop firing about 9 in the morning, as I said. But Hamas said it would not stop firing and kept firing and fired about 50 rockets, according to the Israelis, into Israel, some wounding people, and about, let's say, 5-6 hours after 9 a.m., Israel announced that it would resume operations in Gaza, and they are hitting Gaza again.
And listeners, if you have a question for Stephen Erlanger from the New York Times in Jerusalem, you can call up right now. A pretty rare opportunity to talk to a reporter on the ground there directly. Obviously, I know there are strong opinions on both sides of this, so you can voice some of those as well. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But we'll definitely give some priority to anybody who has a question for Stephen Erlanger as he tries to clarify the situation for us from Jerusalem. 212-433-WNYC. There is a lot of they started it talk on both sides, as always happens in these situations. Can you remind us of how this latest round of fighting did get started?
Well, you know, it's like they say in New Hampshire, you can't get there from here. I mean, you could start with the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which called for a Jewish homeland in British Palestine. But basically what happened, I think, began with the collapse of the American-led peace talks. Many people said to John Kerry at the time, if you're going to go into them, you better have a pretty good notion of getting somewhere, because often when they fail, things get worse, because both sides have to emphasize, you know, how unyielding they've been. So that was followed by this horrible kidnap and murder of 3 Israeli teenagers who were hitchhiking in a settlement near Hebron, and that had the country captivated and miserable when they were found dead. There was a revenge killing of a young 17-year-old, 16-year-old Palestinian boy who was lifted just before morning prayers at about 3 in the morning and brutally beaten and burned alive, or simply wasn't dead when we were burned. And that set off the usual horror. Israel, in the meantime, blamed Hamas for the kidnap and killing of the 3 Israelis and started rounding up a lot of Hamas people in the West Bank, including parliamentarians and including, importantly, people who had been released from Israeli prisons under the deal that released the Israeli kidnapped victim Gilad Shalit. You know, if you remember, he'd been kidnapped for quite a long time. Now, the Egyptians, under the old Muslim Brotherhood government, had guaranteed that these Palestinian prisoners released under Gilad Shalit would not be rearrested. But at least 53 of them had been rearrested. And in the meantime, in Gaza, Hamas faces a very different Egyptian government, because al-Sisi essentially did a military coup. He's very anti-Hamas. So Hamas is sealed from Egypt, it's sealed pretty much from Israel, and it's sealed by sea, where Israeli boats patrol the sea space. So Hamas was having trouble paying salaries, its tunnel systems were shut down by the Egyptians, it couldn't collect taxes, it couldn't pay its 1,000 or so employees. And then they went into a unity government with Fatah, which is the West Bank. This is Abu Mazen, President Abbas. And the Israelis didn't like that. They didn't think that was a very workable thing. And the Americans didn't like it either, because the argument was it brought Hamas, which is listed as a terrorist group by the Americans and the Europeans, into a government that's supposed to be committed to a two-state solution, which Hamas is not. So that has produced a feeling on Hamas's part that they have nowhere to turn. They're getting very little benefit from this unity government. The Fatah is not paying salaries either in Gaza. And I think Hamas felt it needs to break out of this, you can call it the siege, but this horrible deteriorating situation for themselves. So that will be their political demands to stop Biden.
Stephen Erlanger, New York Times, London bureau chief, former Jerusalem bureau chief, back in Jerusalem now, covering the latest fighting between Israel and Hamas. Let's take a phone call. Ledwin in East Orange. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling. Good morning.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Okay.
The comment you played earlier from the Palestinian spokesperson, I remember I heard it this morning, and it was a guy, I think he said he was deputy information minister for Hamas.
Right.
One interesting comment he had this morning was he said that nobody consulted them on the ceasefire and that they only found out through the media, and that was one of their issues. So I wanted to know what the guests had to say about that and if that's true and exactly can Egypt just declare ceasefires? Is that how this works?
Do you know that to be true? That was part of the clip that we replayed from Morning Edition today, where he says they learned about it through the media, not through any official channels. Is that true?
Well, certainly the people in Gaza, the Hamas people in Gaza, I think were not consulted. But Hamas is a larger organization, and its political chief is in Qatar. And I'd be a little bit surprised if Khaled Meshaal wasn't consulted. At the same time, you know, given that conflict is going on, Hamas has a military wing, which is very powerful, in some ways more powerful than the political wing inside Gaza. And the political wing is more eager for a ceasefire right now than the military wing, which ironically also does not like this agreement with Fatah. Here, the military wing and the Israeli government are of the same mind. So Hamas is, you know, it's not exactly like you press a button and everything stops and everybody gets the same information at the same time. It's always worked by consultation. It has a kind of secretive shura or council of people who make big decisions, and it takes some time for them to get to the point. So we'll see. I mean, my guess is that the ceasefire, I hope, certainly will restore itself, you know, fairly soon, maybe tomorrow, I don't know. And then these talks can begin. My worry, of course, is that, you know, in the face of more rocketry, Israel will feel it needs to escalate its military activities in Gaza, including some incursions on the ground. I mean, I was just in Gaza for 4 or 5 days, just came out, and, you know, it's really no fun. I mean, to some degree, the people of Gaza are kind of prisoners of the whole situation. I mean, they're not in charge of Hamas either, and they have nowhere to go. I mean, they can't emigrate. No one ever lets them out. So it's hard to figure out where to flee.
Which I think sets up this next question from a caller nicely. John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Hi. I noticed they slipped a little thing in there. Open the border. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that you know, all the Palestinians become Israeli citizens, that they can go back and forth, that they can infiltrate Israel and commit terrorism, they can bring the values that have destroyed Lebanon and the other countries they controlled to Israel? What does open the borders mean?
Yes, what did he mean in that clip when he said conditions that they would require for a ceasefire include lifting the siege and opening the border? He did say opening the border. So what would that mean?
Well, what he's talking about is Egypt. The border with Egypt, which is Rafah, because Egypt has pretty much sealed the border. I mean, no one is talking about opening up the border freely to Israel. There is a crossing. You need permits. It's very difficult. And, of course, Israel is still sending in some food and supplies and medical supplies. I mean, Gaza gets a certain amount of its goods and services from Israel, including much of its power. So really what's at issue here is the relationship with Egypt and the rough crossing into Egypt.
And I heard a comment on NPR yesterday afternoon that said, if anything, the Egyptian government is more anti-Hamas than the Israeli government. Would you say that's true?
Well, that's hard to know. It's hard to read minds. But there's no question that General al-Sisi overthrew the duly elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas is an offshoot or is the Palestinian branch of of the Muslim Brotherhood. And under Morsi, the tunnels flourished and trade with Egypt went up and the border was generally open. And the Israelis were worried because quite a lot of weapons were coming in. And also the Sinai was quite lawless for Egypt. So Sisi's basically done a crackdown on everything, on free speech and on, you know, political activity, but he's certainly done a crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood is, you know, Hamas.
I want to play a clip of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Face the Nation Sunday, blaming Hamas for the Palestinian deaths. And by the way, do you have the count in front of you that there have been, in this latest fighting, there have actually been no Israeli casualties, despite the terror, genuine terror that Israelis feel from these rockets being fired into new parts of Israel, because I guess Hamas missiles have longer range than they used to. Mm-hmm. But no Israelis killed. How many Palestinians killed?
Depends on who's counting, but it's about 185. I tend to use figures from the UN branch called OCHA, and they try to distinguish between combatant and civilian deaths. And they feel that at least 60% of the 180 or so deaths so far have been civilian. And obviously quite a few children have died. Is, by casualty, you mean death. I mean, obviously some Israelis have been wounded, some of them seriously.
So casualty is the wrong word. Fatality would have been more accurate.
To be clear,
thank you for being clear. So some Israelis have been wounded by these Hamas rockets. Here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Face the Nation Sunday, blaming Hamas for the civilian Palestinian deaths, not just the combatant deaths, because he said in Gaza they embed their missile sites in civilian areas.
The difference between us is that we're using missile defense to protect our civilians, and they're using their civilians to protect their missiles. So naturally, they're responsible for all the civilian deaths that occur accidentally. We're sorry for any accidental civilian death, but it's the Hamas that bears complete responsibility for such civilian casualty.
So, Steve Erlanger, can you fact check that statement by Netanyahu? How true is that the Hamas leadership in Gaza literally embeds their missile sites in civilian areas to use the civilian population as human shields?
Well, without getting into the politics of it, because I'm not a politician and Mr. Netanyahu is, you know, there is no question that in crowded Gaza, Hamas has been using tunnels. It's dug many tunnels in the various cities of Gaza, and it has most of its rockets underground and firing through slits in the earth that are quickly then covered over. You have the people operating some of these rockets who go into a house and then go into a tunnel that's inside the house and pass through the tunnel to get to the rocket launchers when they launch them. So it's very difficult in the first place for Israel to find the launchers from the air, but it is also true that many of these are in crowded city spaces. Not all of them are. The other thing one should ask oneself is, you know, to say Hamas is responsible for every single civilian death, one I think also should ask whether there have been a few mistakes. The Israelis have tried. I think I've watched them to be pretty careful to hit only what they want to hit. But they sometimes have bad intelligence. I was at a center for the disabled that was destroyed by a Hellfire missile. And there was no indication that there were, you know, Islamic Jihad or Hamas people in the building, though some may have been lived in there years before. And that was a particularly, horrible event. And then Israel has also been quite openly saying that it is bombing the houses and infrastructure of senior Hamas officials. They're trying to kill certain senior Hamas officials. And just the other day, the police chief of Hamas, and then Taser al-Botch, was coming out of the mosque after evening prayers and visiting his aunt's house. And they were trying to kill him, and they took a three-story house and it leveled. It was completely leveled, and 18 people died, 17 members of the Abach family, the extended family, and one neighbor. So, you know, I think it is fair to say Israel bears at least some responsibility for the errors that it may make, even if it's trying not to make them.
But in addition to that, does the Hamas leadership place these missile sites in crowded urban areas, as you say?
Yes.
Precisely because, are they so politically cynical as to place them there because they know that civilians will die when Israel goes after the missiles, and it gives them more political potency as a result?
Well, you know, I don't know what's exactly in their heads. I think part of the way they do it, why they do it, is because they are trusting that Israel will be careful and that Israel will be reluctant to strike heavily populated places, so that these are, for them, safer places to put their rockets, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. It's also true that in this kind of, you know, conflict, which is very disproportionate in terms of power, right? I mean, Israel could wipe Gaza off the map if it chose to. It clearly doesn't choose to. But, you know, getting the attention of the world through victims is an important part of fighting the information battle. And it causes, you know, Western leaders to urge ceasefires on Israel to avoid a mounting level of bloodshed. So, you know, you can regard both these things cynical, but I think both of them are at play.
Paul in Garden City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. My question comes from the fact that I'm from Haiti. In Haiti, we see everything from the point of view of Haitian history, where it's a great thing for an oppressed people to rise up and fight for their freedom. And that's why we would support the Israeli fight against the British to gain their freedom, and the American Revolution against the British as well. And what I can't understand is why can't the Israelis see that the Palestinians are oppressed and give them their freedom, and why is it not legitimate for them to fight for their freedom as Haitians did against the French?
Interesting question and interesting framing. Steve, how do you think Israeli officials or even the average Israeli on the street might answer that question in that context?
Well, I think they would say that this is a struggle for the existence of Israel, they would say, because Hamas is dedicated to the removal of Israel. Hamas regards all of British Mandate Palestine as waqf land, in other words, land given by Allah, by God, to the Muslims, and only to the Muslims. So, you know, Hamas, in its charter, wants Israel to disappear, and they say all the Israelis should go back home where they came from, places like Poland and Germany and the United States. So, you know, that makes it complicated. What you have, of course, is a fight among two peoples over land, but also over legitimacy. On the West Bank, I mean, President Abbas has agreed that Israel has a right to exist, which is different than Hamas. He has negotiated with Israel to try to create a Palestinian state in both the West Bank and Gaza. That has been very frustrating. He has bitterly criticized the Israeli settlement program, believing that Israel wants to make a Swiss cheese state if the Palestinians ever have one. And so he certainly doesn't believe in the same religious, you know, demand that Israel disappear that Hamas does. But it makes it very hard to have a unity government when the two major Palestinian wings differ so much on what's going to be the right outcome.
And, Paul, thank you for your call. We're just about out of time. Let me ask you just one kind of Palestinian political question. There are Palestinian elections coming up soon, right? The first one since 2006 when Hamas was elected in Gaza?
Well, they're supposed to come. I covered those elections in 2006 because I was here then, and the Hamas victory was a big shock to lots of people. And, you know, the hope was that Hamas would, you know, govern responsibly, but it's also Israel worked to undermine Hamas, seeing it as a terrorist organization, which it had been, you know, certainly. And so it's very, very, very hard to say, to be honest. There is...
To say what? Whether elections will be held?
Well, I mean, first, I don't even know if there's going to be elections. They've been postponed and postponed and postponed.
I see.
You certainly can't have elections when rockets are flying. And what worries me is what the fate of Abu Mazen is. He's not young. He smokes. He's had a heart condition. He's the head also of the PLO, which is the sole negotiating authority for the Palestinians.
And he represents
out of the PLO.
The Palestinians in the West Bank, really. And my question is really about Gaza. If there was to be an election, as the people continue to live in such miserable conditions, are they only outraged at Israel? Or might there be political repercussions for Hamas leadership from this if Palestinian elections were to come up, where maybe there would be a peace party? You know, Israeli politics is full of hawks and doves. You know, what would happen in a free and open election in Gaza?
Well, of course, it's hard to know, and the polls are slightly unreliable. Hamas is not, you know, wildly popular in Gaza. It is pretty popular, though, in Gaza and in the West Bank because it's seen as resisting the Israeli occupation, while Fatah is seen as playing games with Israel. That's been part of the problem. I think Fatah would win an overall election because government has been very hard on Hamas. And a lot of people are critical of it. But to say they have no support in Gaza would be wrong. And to say that there isn't, in general, solidarity with what Gazans, rightly or wrongly, see as a response to Israeli aggression would also be wrong. That's part of what's so, frankly, sad about the whole business.
Stephen Erlanger reporting for The New York Times from Jerusalem, with the hoped-for ceasefire to take effect about an hour and a half ago, not happening. They're still talking. Meanwhile, the rockets are still being fired on each side. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Advocates Report Card. How's de Blasio doing on keeping crime down and respectful policing up? Stay with us.